reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The U.S. is blasting a move by the world's top criminal court to seek arrest warrants for Israeli leaders and leaders of Hamas, a U.S.-designated terrorist group. AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
Among those Karim Khan wants to charge,
the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Here in Washington,
the United States fundamentally rejects the announcement today.
As the president said, is outrageous.
Both State Department spokesman Matthew Miller and White House National Security spokesman John Kirby ripped the move.
There should be no equivalence between Israel and Hamas.
A three-judge panel will decide whether to issue the warrants. But even if they are issued, since Israel is not a member of the court, neither Netanyahu nor his defense minister face any immediate prosecution risk. Sagar Magani, Washington.
A U.S. counterterrorism official speaking in Qatar Monday said that the Hamas surprise attack inside Israel that launched the current war in Gaza has upended the U.S. strategy in the Middle East, and its implications are reverberating globally.
Speaking at the 2024 Global Security Forum in Doha Monday, director of the U.S. National Counterterrorism Center, Christine Avezzad, called the Hamas attack one of the most consequential terror attacks since the September 11, 2001 attacks on the U.S., and it has changed the way the Counterterrorism Center does its job. She said it is a reminder they have to stay focused on the global threat environment.
It reminds us whether you're focused on the Iran threat, the Al-Qaeda threat, the ISIS threat, the lone actor threat, the racially or ethnically motivated violent extremist threat, the anti-institutionalist, anti-government threat. All of these threats exist all at the same time, and we have to be vigilant.
Jeff Custer, VOA News.
And more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Haiti's main international airport reopened Monday for the first time in nearly 3 months after relentless gang violence forced authorities to close it. The reopening of the airport in the capital of Port-au-Prince is expected to help ease a critical shortage of medications and other basic supplies. The country's main seaport remains paralyzed. Gangs control about 80% of the capital. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told Reuters in an exclusive interview Monday his Western allies are taking too long to make key decisions on sending military support to Ukraine. Reuters correspondent Chris Dignam.
Every decision takes ages. We arrive at this decision later on, but it's like 1 year too late.
Zelensky also said he was pushing Western partners to get more directly involved in the war by helping to intercept Russian missiles and to allow Ukraine to use Western weapons against enemy military equipment at the border and further inside Russian territory. The United States has resisted Ukrainian calls to use its missiles against internationally recognized Russian territory, reflecting concerns in the West about the risk of escalation.
The Environmental Protection Agency warns that cyber attacks against water utilities around the United States are becoming more frequent and more severe. The agency Monday issued an alert urging water systems to take immediate action to protect the nation's drinking water. The EPA said about 70% of utilities inspected by federal officials over the past year violated standards meant to protect cyber attacks. They cited basic errors such as failing to change default passwords or cut off system access to former employees. EPA says nations including Russia, China, and Iran are actively seeking the ability to disable critical U.S. infrastructure. Many water systems have modest staffing and resources to harden themselves against attacks. More from Reuters' David Doyle on former South African President Jacob Zuma being disqualified from running for a seat in parliament in next week's national election because of a previous criminal conviction.
This was a closely watched decision because of its potential to influence the outcome of the vote. Zuma, who was forced to quit as president in 2018, has fallen out with the governing African National Congress. Instead, he's been campaigning for Umkhonto we Sizwe, a new party named after the ANC's former armed wing. Opinion polls suggest the ANC's majority is at risk for the first time in 3 decades. And MK, as it's known, is a threat, especially in Zuma's home province of KwaZulu-Natal.
That's Reuters' David Doyle reporting. You'll find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 21st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Africa's Constitutional Court says former President Jacob Zuma is not eligible to stand for parliament in next week's general election.
How is it possible that 10 human beings that are unelected by members of civil society get to make a decision for the electoral process of this country?
Rwanda deploys another 2,500 soldiers to help Mozambique fight the insurgency in Cabo Delgado province. A Kenya media hub helped journalists in exile. The leader of Rwanda's opposition Green Party submits his application for the July 15 elections.
We are running for presidency for several reasons, but first is to make sure that every Rwandan has something to eat. We want to make sure that we solve the problem of food insecurity because our country is still importing food from outside the country.
And Biden and Trump clash over gun rights. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The spokesperson for the Umkhonto Wesizwe, or MK party, says South Africa's constitution must be changed. This after the Constitutional Court ruled on Monday that former President Jacob Zuma is ineligible to stand for parliament in next week's general election. MK spokesperson Lamulo Dalala tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the country is now in a constitutional crisis.
As you recall, we stated categorically that we expect and have requested that the six judges, unelected six judges, or should we say 10 judges and the 60% of them being the six, that are in effect conflicted in this matter, which we requested that their recusal of this matter, which they didn't do. Now, naturally, you would expect that their judgment would be such that it protects their 15-month sentence that they handed down against President Zuma in the first place. Otherwise, them coming out with a different kind of judgment than what they did today would have gone against the mistake that they did.
Are you saying there's a conspiracy here?
I'm saying that this is a constitutional crisis. This is a constitutional crisis, and it further confirms why we need to change the constitution. I mean, how is it possible that 10 human beings that are unelected by members of civil society, unelected by members of civil society, get to make a decision for the electoral process of this country?
But isn't it the legal process for which every South African is subjected to? So if a judgment has come and you are calling it a constitutional crisis, then where does that leave the judiciary of South Africa?
That's the whole point that I'm making, that even the judiciary of the South African judiciary system is flawed. Here are judges that are making a decision and presiding over a matter they should be recusing themselves from. They handed down a 15-month sentence. Agreeing with the electoral court judgment for them would have been going against what their mistake that they made. So the President Zuma never went to court. It's the IEC that took us to court, the electoral court. And they never liked the outcome of the electoral court. Took it further to the constitutional court.
So with this decision handed down by the constitutional court, what's the next line of action for the MK Umkhonto Wesizwe party?
Well, essentially, it doesn't change the fact that President Zuma is on the ballot. His face will be on the ballot, so that doesn't change. The second point it doesn't change is that it doesn't change President Zuma being a president of the party. Thirdly, it just further reinforces the need for citizens of this country to take control of this judicial system and ensure that it serves them by voting in their majority, a two-third majority, to ensure we change the constitution so they can get President Zuma as president of the country. That's it. And that's what's going to happen. We're not perturbed by this outcome. We knew that these judges will not go against themselves. How could they do so?
So the MK party is using this as a political campaign weapon for the upcoming May 29 election?
We're using it to demonstrate to South Africans the lack of parity and that this Lady Justice has got eyes to further advance our agenda of getting a two-third majority.
But isn't this on again, off again legal tussle going to affect the prospect of the Umkhonto Wesizwe party?
No, it can't affect our electoral prospects. It just further justifies and confirms what we stand for or what we've been raising. All the issues that we've highlighted are at play here.
Lamulo Nglela is the spokesperson for the Umkhonto we Sizwe, or MK Party of South Africa. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. The United States has been reacting to Sunday's alleged attempted coup in the Democratic Republic of Congo that authorities there say was intended to destabilize the country's institutions. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said Monday in policy statement that the U.S. condemns the armed attacks on the Democratic Republic of Congo's National Assembly, Deputy, and the National Palace, and denounced all forms of political violence. Miller said the U.S. is extremely concerned by the reports of involvement by U.S. citizens and is closely monitoring the situation and will cooperate with DRC authorities to the fullest extent possible to investigate any involvement of U.S. citizens. With respect to the individual who is deceased, Miller said, "We do not have any record of him being a United States citizen." He refused to comment due to privacy restrictions on the other two who are said to be United States citizens and are reported to be in custody. The leader of Rwanda's opposition Green Party says he is running to be the country's next president to solve the problems of food insecurity and youth unemployment, among others. Frank Habineza submitted his candidature yesterday, Monday, for the July 15 poll. The Rwandan government denied the application of another opposition leader, Victoire Ingabire Umuhoza, in the elections because she had been convicted and imprisoned. Habineza tells me that the Electoral Commission told him his application needed a letter saying he has no other nationality besides Rwanda.
Today, myself and the members of the Democratic Green Party of Rwanda went to the National Electoral Commission to submit our candidature for the presidency of the Republic of Rwanda for the July 2024 presidential elections. But we also submitted candidatures for parliamentary candidates. So the event went quite well, although they say that there were an important document I did not carry, which regards not having other citizenship. So for that, previously I had Swedish citizenship. I renounced it in 2017 when I stood for the first time for the presidency. So I thought that I don't have to submit that again since I'm no longer a Swedish citizen since 7 years ago. But they say that I'll need to submit that once again. The second thing they said was an application letter for the presidential candidature, which was not among the requirements, but not a problem. I'll submit that tomorrow. So I would say that 99% the event went well.
Let me understand. The Elections Commission chairperson was questioning the lack of a letter from you applying for what? Submitting your citizenship?
No, it's a, yeah, they said a letter applying for submitting a candidature. That's what they said, that I should have applied to some the letter. But among the requirements that we had, that that was not among the requirements, but they mentioned that. So it's a simple thing, it's just writing a letter. I'll do that tomorrow. So the other thing was proof that I don't have another citizenship. So I don't think that I had to give that proof because I'd given that proof to the National Electoral Commission 7 years ago when I stood for presidency in 2017. So, but she said that I need to do that again. Well, not a problem. I still have the documents. I will give them tomorrow.
What are you putting forward? What are you telling the people of Rwanda? Why are you running for president?
We are running for presidency for several reasons, but first is to make sure that everyone has something to eat, that everyone has the food on the table. We want to make sure that we solve the problem of food insecurity because our country is still importing food from outside the country. We are importing rice from Bangladesh, from India, from Tanzania and elsewhere. So I need to make sure that my country has enough food for everyone. Secondly, I need to also make sure that I solve the problem of unemployment. We have unemployment rate now at 22% for the youth. We also need to improve our security situation. As you know, that Rwanda is surrounded by several countries which have been threatening to attack our country. Even though we've had aeroplanes from Congo. So we need to improve our security, but by promoting the peaceful means of conflict resolution. At the moment, we have our border with Burundi closed. So I need to make sure that we cannot have any border closed with our neighbors.
Mr. Habineza, you know that opposition leader Victoire Ingabire is not allowed to participate in this election. Now,
What are your chances?
I am the opposition leader, actually, in Rwanda, because it's my party, the first party that won parliamentary elections for the first time after almost 30 years. We entered Rwandan parliament as the first opposition party, and my party had three parliamentarians, who have two members of parliament and one senator. So we are the biggest opposition party in parliament because other parties are in the ruling coalition. So the lady you have mentioned, she's a position person, but she doesn't have a registered political party. My party is regularly registered since 2013. So we are the legitimate opposition party, and I'm the opposition leader.
Frank Habineza is the leader of Rwanda's opposition Green Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kigali. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 21st. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Rwanda is deploying an additional 2,500 soldiers to help Mozambique fight resurgent attacks by Islamic State insurgents in oil-rich Cabo Delgado province. Attacks have been on the rise in the area as a force known as SAMIM, deployed by the Southern African Development Community, prepares to withdraw. Charles Maguire has more from Mozambique's capital, Maputo.
President Philippe Nyusi was quoted by state-run radio late Sunday as saying the troops are being deployed not because Mozambique cannot ensure its own defense, but because the country cannot fight terrorism alone. Nyusi, who is to step down in January 2025 at the end of his second five-year term, said it is clear that Rwanda is cooperating with Mozambique, adding that his greatest pride will be to leave things well done to ensure continuity. He said more contingents are disembarking, not to exchange, but to aid flow. And this is mainly because of the departure of SAMIM, and when it definitely leaves the hotspot area, we will occupy it. Nyusi made the statement during a review of the visit he made to Rwanda's capital last week. He was in Kigali to attend the Africa CEO Forum, and he seized the opportunity to meet with his Rwandan counterpart, Paul Kagame, and the chief executive officer of French company Total Energies, Patrick Pouyanné. Cabo Delgado has been facing an armed insurgency since 2017 that has disrupted several multi-billion oil and natural gas projects. 3 years ago, Rwanda deployed 1,000 soldiers to fight alongside Mozambique's armed defense and was joined by SAMIM. The regional intervention force will completely withdraw in July, forcing the Mozambican Armed Defense Forces, FADM, to fill the security vacuum. Total Energies is building a plant near Palma for the production and export of natural gas at the cost of $20 billion, but the project has been suspended since 2021. Rwanda's military support to Mozambique was welcomed by Total Energies chief Pouyanné, who said the natural gas project district will soon resume.
I believe that we have progressed very positively with all contractors, and so we are, from this point of view, ready to resume. So we are also working with all the credit agencies to resume the financing of the project, and it's progressing well.
ExxonMobil, with partner Eni, is also developing a liquefied natural gas project in northern Mozambique, and said last week it was optimistic and looking forward to the security situation to improve. SAMIM's withdrawal from Mozambique, the result of financial difficulties, comes at a time when terrorist attacks have increased in Cabo Delgado. A week ago, Islamic State-backed insurgents ransacked the major town of Macumia in Cabo Delgado province following a dawn assault in which over 20 soldiers may have been killed, according to local media reports. A senior project leader for South Africa-based Institute of Justice and Reconciliation, Webster Zambara, said SADC should reconsider its withdrawal.
Actually, it's the first time in Southern Africa where we would have a troop from East Africa stationed in one country to fight a war. That actually is affecting not only one country, Mozambique, but threatens Tanzania, also Malawi, and probably the whole region. And the bigger picture is that terrorism issues tend to be very long if we are to look at Al-Shabaab in East Africa and also Boko Haram in West Africa. So we may actually need to see SADC revisiting its position on this.
Last month, the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, issued an appeal for almost $500 million in emergency aid to support affected and displaced Mozambicans in Cabo Delgado. The humanitarian crisis there has left 1.3 million people needing humanitarian aid. Charles Mangwiro for VOA News, Maputo, Mozambique.
Journalists living in exile in Kenya are finding support to continue working in their professions thanks to a fellowship provided by media groups. From Nairobi, Victoria Amunga has more.
Isra Dawood's job in media came to an abrupt end in 2023 as a war erupted between rival factions in Sudan. The journalist fled her home in Khartoum.
We had to move from our house to another region because we stayed like for 10 days, but after that we started to hearing some news about women get kidnapped and get raped, and that was for us, it is frightening.
Arriving in Kenya last May, Dawood had to rebuild her life. Thanks to a media support program, she had a helping hand. An initiative between the German-based Media Incorporation and Transition, or MICT, and African partners helped enroll her in a hub for exiled media. She received a MICT fellowship that includes financial and legal help and safe working spaces for journalists affected by conflict in Sudan and East Africa. She also received training and connections to media outlets that can publish her work.
I wrote 3 articles, of course, under the supervision of the project. So I always, when I was sending the materials, sometimes they have small maybe comments that you should focus on this, you should write this. I think this a good learning process.
So far, the hub has helped at least 80 journalists globally, 15 of them in Kenya. A panel reviews and selects applicants. Jay Wena is the director of the MICT Fellowship Program.
The fellowship usually runs for about 3 to 4 months, and the holistic support structure consists of 7 concrete modules which are offered on an individual basis and include livelihood support, security considerations, mental and physical health support, integration and legalization offers.
Partners in the program, like the International Press Association of East Africa, or IPA, help by setting up press credentials and finding publications willing to pay for articles. They also provide working spaces. Ventura Kireki is programs manager for IPA.
This is basically a huge chunk of what we are trying to even continue more, and especially expanding to have this co-working space where people can come and even just brainstorm creative ways of doing things, you know, new ways.
Conflict and repression are forcing hundreds of journalists to exile each year, say UNESCO. Misako Aito is UNESCO advisor for communication.
You also have journalists who face political repression, legal harassment, censorship, risk of retaliation from criminal groups, or simply lack of job opportunities and weakening media landscape.
And in Sudan, UNESCO estimates over 8.5 million people have been displaced in the past year, including journalists like Dawood, who hope to return home soon. Until then, media hubs like this one offer support and some normalcy to those in exile. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
A court in Mali has sentenced the well-known academic Etienne Fakaba Sisoko to 2 years in prison, one of which is suspended for criticizing the military regime. According to the French news agency AFP, his lawyer Ibrahim Mahouf Sako said in a video released on social media that he would appeal. Sisoko is an economist and professor at the University of Bamako. He is the latest victim of a crackdown on criticism by the colonels who took power in 2020. He was charged with harming the reputation of the state, defamation and dissemination of false news disturbing the public peace over his 2023 book called Propaganda, Agitation and Harassment, Government Communication During the Transition in Mali. Guns have divided American voters, with nearly equal numbers taking opposite sides in the gun safety debate, according to Pew Research polling. U.S. presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump also have opposing views on guns and gun control. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns reports.
Nearly a third of Americans say they have a gun, according to the Pew Research Center. It's a constitutional right that often becomes a political issue for presidents when there are school shootings, including this one at a Florida high school in 2018, which ended with police evacuating students hiding in their classroom. Then President Donald Trump met with families of the victims to talk about gun violence.
It's been going on too long, too many instances, and we're going to get it done.
As president, Trump's gun policies focused mostly on strengthening school security, including suggesting that teachers be armed. As a presidential candidate, Trump told the nation's top gun lobby Saturday that guns are vital to personal safety.
Our country is going to hell. Rapacious gangs and ruthless criminals are terrorizing our streets, and crooked Joe Biden's weakness has us teetering on the edge of World War III.
Accepting the National Rifle Association's endorsement, Trump said Biden is trying to, quote, rip firearms out of the hands of law-abiding citizens and gut gun rights guaranteed in the Constitution's Second Amendment.
We have to have a Second Amendment that's meaningful. If we don't, we're going to have levels of death and destruction like this country has never seen before.
When a teen gunman killed 19 children and two teachers at a Texas elementary school in 2022, President Biden said, quote, we have to act.
As a nation, we have to ask, when in God's name are we going to stand up to the gun lobby? When in God's name we do what we all know in our gut needs to be done?
The White House and Congress agreed on a bipartisan plan expanding background checks for younger gun buyers and helping states remove firearms from people who pose a danger to themselves or others. Biden is campaigning on those tougher laws, especially in communities marked by gun violence.
I signed the most significant gun safety law in nearly 30 years, which I know matters to the community that I mourn with. And I remember in Atlanta, Half Moon Bay, and Monterey Park.
There's been no further gun control legislation since Republicans won control of the House in 2022. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries blames Trump supporters.
Today, the MAGA extremists in the do-nothing Republican Congress are leaving town without meaningfully addressing the gun violence epidemic in America.
U.S. voters' views on guns divide largely along political lines, with Pew Research data showing Republicans and Republican-leaning independents are more than twice as likely to own a gun as Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
And that's it for this Tuesday, May 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Butty, Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.
College degree is a great achievement. However, your next step, that of finding a job, can be daunting. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we will explore how new graduates can get ready for the workforce and discuss the need for soft skills to help boost their chances of employment. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on the Voice of America.
Around the clock, the Voice of America keeps you in touch with the latest news.
Tune in at the top of every hour, every day of the week.
For the 5-minute VOA newscast.
We bring you reports from our correspondents and interviews with newsmakers from around the globe.
Give us 5 minutes and we'll give you the world.
VOA, your choice.